From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Crime novels can be set anywhere, Beijing, Detroit, Stockholm. But for a long time, the classic noir setting for American crime fiction was Los Angeles. Think Chinatown or The Big Sleep. It defined our fears and fantasies. Now, says my guest today, Adam Gopnik of The New Yorker, that job has moved to Florida. This hour, On Point, finding America's new face in the wacky, seedy world of Florida crime fiction. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. Are you there already with Carl Hiaasen, John D. McDonald, detectives in Miami, the Keys, in the Everglades? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. When it was L.A., well, maybe this was the sound of it. 1974, Chinatown, Roman Polanski's classic, and this classic line.
Go home, Jake. I'm doing you a favor.
Forget it, Jake. It's Chinatown.
Forget it, Jake. It's Chinatown. But a lot has moved to Florida. It can be wacky and seedy and bizarre as you want to be. Showtime's series Dexter goes right there. Here's sound from the very first episode.
Tonight's the night. And it's going to happen again and again. Has to happen. Miami is a great town. I love the Cuban food. Pork sandwiches, my favorite. But I'm hungry for something different now.
Yeah, Dexter in Miami. Carl Hiaasen, big in this world, out with his latest Bad Monkey. He's got a tourist pulling up a severed arm off a chartered fishing boat, voodoo princess, that bad-tempered monkey, greedy real estate developers, kinky sex on an autopsy table. Carl Hiaasen was with us a couple of years ago talking about how in Florida, his job is staying ahead of reality.
These are all very close to being real people, as most Floridians know. My books tend to be viewed as documentaries here, not so much as satire. And the news just keeps getting weirder, and the challenge is staying ahead of it. I mean, I'm fond of all those characters, as twisted as they are, but I've met various incarnations of them along the road.
Carl Hiaasen's latest is Bad Monkey. Joining me now from New York is Adam Gopnik, writer for The New Yorker. His latest piece is In the Back Cabana, The Rise and Rise of Florida Crime Fiction. You can find an excerpt of it at our website, onpointradio.org. He's the author of The Table Comes First, The Steps Across the Water, Through the Children's Gate, and many more. Adam Gopnik, welcome back to On Point.
Hey, Tom. Wonderful to be back.
I love this essay, and it made me realize that I'm one of those who's gotten tangled up in the fishing tackle of Florida crime fiction. And it is different. And I maybe we sort of start at the end of your essay and work backwards into some of the detail here. But give us a sense of how you see the role that L.A. noir detective crime fiction played, what it said about America, the moment it grew out of. And then we'll roll it forward to Florida and what's going on now. What was the L.A. dynamic?
Let me see if I can try to summarize it. Of course, Tom, when we're talking about these cities, we're talking about cities of the imagination, of the mind, rooted in real experience. Mm-hmm. But, you know, if you were in L.A. in 1947, I doubt that when you were walking along, saxophones were playing in the background. And I'm sure many people...
Maybe now and then.
Occasionally, yeah, but, yeah. You know, and nor were you in black and white photography. And
sure.
I'm sure many people live in Florida without ever encountering random acts of comic violence.
Yes.
But the way we represent cities and the way we represent ourselves, is as important as what they are in some practical sense. So it always has seemed to me, or it occurred to me as I was doing this reading, that the classic American noir is all about hidden connections. You know, this is true whether it's in Raymond Chandler, where the fundamental lesson you get in every Chandler book is that the cruddy little life of the hoodlums and the crooks and the big, pretentious life of the gazillionaires, the tycoons up in the hills, are really part of one story, that they're always end up being connected. And a wonderful writer, Ross McDonald, I think, turned that into a kind of overarching, genuinely a literary principle. I don't know if you recall all those really first-rate Lou Archer novels from the 60s particularly, where the whodunit was never whodunit, but how did it connect, right? That at the end of every Lou Archer book, every element in the book, no matter how disparate it seemed at first, belong to a single story. And that was the thing. And if you think about
it. And this is the 1940s through the 1960s, this kind of classic L.A. noir novel period.
Exactly. And it's still a thriving genre. In fact, it's wrapped itself around the world. Stockholm, for instance, whoever would have thought, right, that peaceful social democratic Sweden would become the site for most famous noir, Dragon Tattoo, and those things. And if you think about it, Tom, there's a core element of truth about that. If you think of all the great scandals and all the great sort of violent events of American life around that time, they all did revolve around the notion that things were – that seemed disconnected were connected. Think about the Kennedy assassination. If no matter how we parse that as conspiracy or one man acting alone, the truth is that what looked like this Camelot up on the hill turned out to have a very sordid and seamy underside.
Or in L.A., the rich man's big house, as you write, hidden up in the canyons and the seedy saloons downtown, part of the same system. Everything was connected but invisible. And you write these were, I mean, because migration was the story to California, part of this was rural America coming to terms with the new environment of its life. Maybe Midwesterners who suddenly found themselves in big, mean city L.A.
Right. That's a very important theme in Chandler. It's an important thing in Ross McDonald. The whole idea that, you know, remember the old joke, the continent is tilted and everything loose falls into California? But that was very much what it was like, right? That you had this exodus from the Dust Bowl and then from all kinds of other forces from the center of the country out onto the edge, onto the western edge, the last place before the Great Pacific. And that was very powerful. You know, I mentioned it's a little detail, but I think a significant one, that it's interesting, right, that the two great teams, or two of the great teams in Los Angeles, the Lakers and the Dodgers, right, are total transplants from elsewhere in the country.
Right.
As so many of the lakes are all in Minneapolis, no lakes in Los Angeles.
Right.
And the Dodgers, the dodging trolley cars, were all back in Brooklyn. That's very much part of the California experience and part of Los Angeles. And that, I think, is one of the things that gave it significance. You know, if you love film noir, as I do, Tom, one of the things, there's so many wonderful American film noir that just start with a shot of neon signs on a darkened Los Angeles street.
Of course, yeah.
Because the signs themselves are a sign, if you like, of the move from a rural country to an urban country. And that's very much kind of the feeling, the underlying movement of the great L.A. noir.
And appetite as the ruling principle in the classic L.A. noir crime fiction.
Yeah, you know, we're still living in a world in the 40s and 50s and even into the 60s where you've got sexual repression. There's a lot of taboo stuff you can't do. Again and again in Chandler and something like The Big Sleep, one of the things that happens is oh my God, there are smutty pictures that are going to be revealed.
Right. And people will do anything to stop them getting out. Anything.
Exactly. Illegitimate children. You can't reveal. Yeah. Now, in Chinatown, which is sort of a wonderful self-conscious culmination, it involves incest as well, right? But nonetheless, illegitimate children, smutty pictures, pornography, these are things that you have to keep the lid down on.
Unbearable taboo.
Exactly. There's a lot of taboo stuff still left in American life.
And into that picture, in the classic noir, comes your private eye, your sort of knight errant with a particular kind of mission in that setting. Not Florida, but we're still in L.A.
Yeah, you know, that's the role of Sam Spade up in San Francisco, or of Philip Marlowe, or of countless others, J.J. Giddies, and so on. They are the last men willing to fight for a cause. That's what the private eye does. Not only does he try and solve the crime, and not only does he often have an overlay of cynicism, but beneath that cynicism, he is the knight errant. He's the man who will walk those mean streets who is not himself mean. In that famous phrase, and that's very much what it's about. And our empathy, our admiration goes to that guy, to the private eye, to Bogart, to Dick Powell even when he plays the part, who is the last repository of vanishing virtue, of the old-fashioned kind of American rectitude that didn't accept smut, corruption, sordidness as a necessary fact of American life.
The private eye trying to, as you write, restore principles of chivalry and compassion to a world that has amputated them. Women shouldn't be tormented. The rich shouldn't have their own rules. Murder shouldn't go unpunished. The key sequence, usually the one in which the bad girl tries to seduce the hero. His rejection of sex is a sign of his moral rectitude. And then we come to Florida, and all of this is off the table, Adam.
Yeah, it seems to me, and you know, I'm one of those people who loves reading crime fiction. I spend an inordinate amount of my time, Tom, on the road, what we call in our family the perpetual tuition tour.
Yes.
Bob Dylan and I think, are the roadiest guys in America. He speaks to thousands and sings to thousands in stadiums, and I speak to 20 or so people in a bookstore. But nonetheless, I spend an immense amount of time on the road. And if you're a road guy, you spend a lot of your time reading, of course. Mm-hmm. And one of the things I find is that the thing that diverts me most in the long delays is crime fiction. I love to read it. And, of course, I'm a big Elmore Leonard fan. And going back, I was a big John D. MacDonald fan. I think John D. MacDonald is the place where the really interesting line in Florida crime fiction starts. He's not as well remembered now, I think, Tom, as he was back when. But he wrote those wonderful Travis McGee
mysteries. Absolutely. We're going to go straight to them. Adam Gopnik, if you'll hold it right there, we will come back and take it right to Florida and Florida crime fiction and the new face of America that Adam Gopnik finds there. Maybe you have as well. Behind us here, the Spam All-Stars, Miami, Florida fusion band with Who Knows. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. We're talking this hour about Florida as the new face of America in Florida crime fiction. Wacky, seedy, international, despoiled, maybe a little random. Adam Gopnik writes about all of it. Just as Carl Hyacin is coming out with his latest Bad Monkey, Adam's piece in The New Yorker is headlined In the Back Cabana, The Rise and Rise of Florida Crime Fiction. You can link to it at our website, onpointradio.org. Here's a little piece from the old school. L.A., Raymond Chandler's crime novel, The Big Sleep. Private detective Philip Marlowe, played by Humphrey Bogart, attempts to solve a man's mysterious disappearance. Old school, L.A. Noir, 1946.
Sometimes I wonder what strange fate brought me out of the storm to that house that stood alone in the shadows. As I probed into its mysteries, every clue told me a different story. But each had the same ending. Murder.
Murder. And Bogart does it. Even Dave Barry has dipped into the Florida crime writing world. We talked with him about his book, Insane City. Here's what Dave Barry had to say about his adopted city of Miami and how common corruption there is among political officials. Dave Barry and I are speaking.
My suggestion over the years has been that to streamline our government, we could swear them in and indict them in one ceremony and just
taking care of business.
But in Miami, like having been in jail for several years for corruption is not necessarily a bar to high public office. It's like it kind of like it almost suggests to the electorate, well, we'll vote for him again. He's experienced. He's got a legal team already.
He got his ticket punched. Come on in. Dave Barry with his Insane City. Swear them in and indict them in one ceremony. Adam Gopnik, take us into the Florida world. You described the face of America, the kind of wrestling of America that was going on in L.A. Noir. What's going on in Florida glare, as you dub it?
Dave Barry is such a funny guy. I don't know that I can compete with his with that nice characterization of it. Seems to me that what's going on in part is that you have an environmental issue, environmental thing. We talked about John D. MacDonald before the break. And what's interesting about John D. MacDonald's writing, it's always seemed to me, is that though his hero, Travis McGee, is a very much a kind of Philip Marlowe-style knight-errant living on a houseboat, as those books develop, all those color-coded books, The Dreadful Lemon Sky and so on, the real thing becomes, the real crime is the rape of the environment. You have this state in Florida where people like Dave Barry coming from Buffalo, where the whole of the North kind of crowds in all of people like my grandparents, right, who were among the, the mobs of retired people enlisted and sent south and so on. And you have a very, very fragile ecology, a very fragile environment, and suddenly it's being hugely overtaxed by greed. And that becomes a thing in itself. It's not so much about corruption in the classic L.A. sense of the water deal under the table,
Chinatown,
though that goes on.
Right.
But it's about the reality to which you can only respond with kind of wild indignation that this beautiful, fragile ecosystem is being totally raped, turned into Newark as you go on. And that sense of environmental rape becomes terribly important. And at the same time, I think what's happening is that you lose the sense of sort of Puritan taboo, which still is so powerful, as we were discussing in the Bogart films, in L.A. Noir, that there's stuff that you simply can't talk about, that can't happen. In contemporary America, and it's particularly evident in a sybaritic society, like as Florida is represented in our heads, mm-hmm. that there's really nothing you can't do. There's no real functioning taboo about sexual exposure, about, as Dave Barry was just saying, about criminal misconduct. All of those old Puritan, they can't do that. They can't say that. We have to prevent that from happening. You'll be blackmailed if that goes on. That's largely vanished.
In these books, you say sexual appetite easily fulfilled, essentially without limits, sex and shame no longer motives. It's a society without basic repressions. There are no dirty secrets. The dirt is just laying around everywhere in these crime fiction renditions of this environment.
Yeah, and you get a very, you know, Elmore Leonard is one of the writers, though not strictly a Florida writer, has written some terrific books set in Florida. And he has that, you know how Elmore Leonard has a very even tone, a totally stoical tone. Nothing shocks Elmore Leonard. There are conversations about killings and then conversations about burgers, and they all take place at that same tone. Quentin Tarantino borrowed that tone, I think, from Elmore Leonard in Pulp Fiction. And I think that that sense that what really troubles us now in America, the things that really we pay attention to, is this kind of carnival of grotesques that unfolds before us every day on television. And as Carl Hiaasen was saying at the top of your show, actually unfolds in life. A lot of people, after I wrote this piece, sent me links to this thing called Florida Man, which is simply a Twitter feed that goes through the actual real crime news in Florida every day, right? Dismemberments, kidnappings, unbelievably grotesque things that are really going on. And exactly as I say, in the bright light of day. This isn't stuff that's swept under the rug. As Dave Barry was just saying, people know that a politician is corrupt and say, huh, he's got some experience in corruption. This is all going on both sort of metaphorically, but also quite literally in the bright glare of day. And that's a very different way of imagining crime, a very different way of imagining transgression, of imagining wrongdoing than we've had in the past.
Adam Gopnik is thinking about Florida crime fiction and the whole country in a way in his essay In the Back Cabana in the latest issue of The New Yorker. He joins us from New York. Adam, lots of people calling in here. Jim in Fayetteville, North Carolina. You're on the air. Thanks for calling, Jim. What do you see? What do you read?
Hi, Tom. Hi, Adam. I love this. Thanks for the topic and the program. As a native Floridian, and I know, and from several generations, you know, listening to even generations past, you know, one or two generations ago, talking about what a wild frontier Florida always was and kind of a lawless place. And it never really got the recognition that when the Old West was frontier, Florida remained frontier, really, even until the advent of the air conditioner brought all of the transplants, I think.
And yeah.
I love the, but the idea that there's still a lot of people who are living by their own rules and who don't, a lot of people who kind of are sociopathic or even psychopaths on the loose in that kind of environment. And the examination of the mix for great prose. I particularly, Charles Williford was another one of the plays. And I love that you mentioned Elmore Leonard. I think Maximum Bob is probably one of the great American novels of the late 20th century, for my money.
So what do you think brought the crime focus from L.A. or California to Florida then, Jim? What do you think moved it?
Well, just the shift of population in. I know if you read Killing Mr. Watson, that great book. I hate when I have memory left. You know, it was always there. The killing of Guy Bradley, you know, by the plume hunters out in Florida Bay at the turn of the century. I mean, there's just the burning of Rosewood. There's just always been this kind of frontier vigilante, real, like I say, a lot of psychopaths on the loose. And I think that by the shift of population, people, you know, like you said, what does a developer love better than a place with corrupt politicians and plenty of virgin land?
And a winter climate. And there you've got Florida. So this is Jim, our native Floridian. We've got John writing in to us. Thank you, Jim. Adam, John is writing in. This is Carl Heist, who reminds us, has a great line in one of his books in this genre, something to the effect that South Florida is a favorite place for people in witness protection, as just about any type of scumbag can fit in there without being noticed. Now, you say at the top, and we say again, look, we know there's all kinds of exceptions here, but in the world of crime fiction, that's how Carl Hyacin sees it. That's how he writes it. There's our native Floridian saying, you know, there's something to it, Adam.
And so many others, as he mentioned, too. You know, another thing I think that really is part of this, Tom, I didn't actually say this in the essay. It just occurred to me as I was listening, is that a lot has to do with dreams and disillusionment, great American subject. It's hard to have a credible dream of great good life in California now in quite the way that people still did, I think, in the 40s and 50s. We see California differently now. But Florida, I'm old enough to remember, Tom, when South Beach, where in Miami, where my grandparents were, was a rundown place where what we now think of as those amazing Art Deco hotels.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it was a hot place with sad old people. And I can remember how that total strip, Collins Avenue, was totally redone and reclaimed and became hugely hip and attractive. And I think you have to have some credible dream of a place. I remember LeBron saying, right, I'm going to take my talents to South Beach, in the way he might have said a generation before, I'm going to take my talents to Los Angeles, to sunny Southern California. So when you have a dream, then you have the possibility of the seedy disillusionment. And I think that particular kind of attraction is still powerful. And the other thing I think that's true, and I mean this in a neutral way, is that you also have ethnic conclaves increasingly in Florida. Cuban and Latin and so on. So that the old American dream of simple assimilation will all be blended together is a little bit less potent. And that leads to this fascinating image of a world in which you have all of these sort of contiguous, all of these contemporary little groupings of people, each with their own ambitions and their own desires and greeds. But instead of being connected in one story that gets revealed at the end, they're sort of like creatures under a microscope, right? They're all squiggling at the same time, but belonging to different environments or to different little worlds.
And the whole country resonating with that somehow. I mean, you write that Chandler's great subject, L.A., was the cynical apparition of connection. Carl Hyacin's, is our powerlessness before contingency. The politics of paranoia has been replaced, you write, by the black comedy of coincidences. Everything's just kind of lying out there side by side together. You say in L.A. Noir, the essential fear is of corruption. In Florida glare, corruption is taken for granted. The thing to fear is chance.
Mm-hmm. I was very struck because, after all, we don't just go to L.A. Noir because we're interested in L.A. We see it as a kind of, if I can use a terrible word, a microcosm, a little representation of our larger condition. I think the same thing is true about Florida crime fiction. I was struck at the time of the Boston Marathon bombings when the whole country, myself included, were watching CNN for this Sonayev brothers and what they were doing, how much it was like an Elmore Leonard or Carl Hyacin book. That is, you had these two total losers, these two kind of Borats with bombs, who suddenly had made themselves the sinister heart of the country. And then, if you remember, they were trapped that night because everybody thought they had held up a 7-Eleven. It turned out they hadn't held it up at all. Some other person had held it up, and they happened to be around. That kind of contingency, chance, coincidence, interweaving with acts of horrific violence, that seems to be so much part of the American condition now, and also that we all watch it as reality television. It's not shaped as a movie filled with nemesis and fate. It's just this unspooling reel of comedy and horror, one coming one right after another. And that's very much the vision that we find in such an indelible form in Carl Hyacin's writings and Dave Barry's and so many other Florida crime writers.
Adam, stand by there for just a moment in New York, if you would. I want to welcome into our conversation from Fort Lauderdale, Florida, Aline Cogdill, mystery fiction aficionado, Floridian, longtime mystery columnist for the Sun Sentinel in Fort Lauderdale, syndicated in over 300 newspapers and publications in her time there, all over the place around the world. Winner, no less, of the 2013 Mystery Writers of America Raven Award for outstanding achievement in the mystery field. Aline Cogdill, thank you so much for being with us today.
Hello, and thank you for having me.
You know,
I'm enjoying this conversation very much.
Well, we're glad, and there you are, right in Florida. You know this world so intimately and well. And here's Adam Gopnik, you know, our tuition tour road warrior, reading it all over the place, dipping in. What do you think of his conclusions about the move from L.A. Noir to Florida glare, he calls it, and what it says about Florida and our country, Aline?
Well, I think there's always been a shift in regional mysteries, and Florida is just really part of that. But Florida has always had a rich tradition of mystery fiction. Even before L.A., one of the first mysteries ever published came out of Florida in 1895. It was Opie Reed's On the Suwannee River, and it dealt with Florida real estate. Those changes, those issues haven't really changed through the years. We deal, as you've said before, with very much with the environment, with politicians who are corrupt, and I agree they should be just, you know, indicted and put into office at the same time, and, you know, lots of land scams. Hyacinth, of course, he specializes in over-the-top, and it's why we read him ever since he stuck a plastic alligator down a tourist's neck and called it tourist season. Yeah. Hyacinth, he's very much not the normal fiction crime fiction writer from Florida, but he does echo what goes on here. We have bizarre crimes. We have crimes of stupidity, and they all kind of come together. I often read Hyacinth like I am reading a documentary, especially Bad Monkey, his latest one.
As over the top as it is, as he says, you read it the same way. This sounds like Florida life to you, Aline.
It is. It is. And at the same time, we have fiction writers, crime fiction writers down here are very grounded in reality, like James W. Hall's Thorn and Randy Wayne White's Doc Ford Mysteries, Jonathan King, a lot of people who are really into what really goes on in Florida as opposed to over the top, like Carl Hyacinth, Dave Barry, who, you know, I think is absolutely hysterical, Tim Dorsey, who also is very much over the top.
Florida, somehow the new canvas on which our American life gets played out in its shadows or its sunshine in Florida glare, Adam Gopnik calls it. Florida crime fiction. Aline Cogdill, please stand by. It's great to have you with us from Fort Lauderdale. Adam Gopnik with us from New York and The New Yorker. A little pit bull behind us right here. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. We're talking this hour about Florida as the new face of America in Florida crime fiction. Wacky, seedy, international, despoiled, maybe random. Adam Gopnik writes about it all in the current issue of The New Yorker. His piece is In the Back Cabana. He joins us this hour from New York, author of so many great books, The Table Comes First, Steps Across the Water, Through the Children's Gate, and many more. Aline Cogdill is with us from Fort Lauderdale, Florida, longtime mystery columnist for the Sun Sentinel in Fort Lauderdale. And we're talking about all these great writers and this Florida setting as what wonderful reads in themselves very often, also as a reflection of what's going on with our country. Adam, Aline, we've got wonderful response here from our listener. Elizabeth writes to us and says, lived there a long time, Florida that is, something about the heat, the steam. She writes, I remember chatting with a man at Kinko's one night in Fort Lauderdale. He said he was a PI, private investigator, told me to call him if I needed my boyfriend checked out. This doesn't happen everywhere, Elizabeth writes to us. And here's a great, Jason is just feeling the vibe. He's putting pen to paper. Jason writes to us on Facebook, no less. I knew the minute she set foot in my trailer home that she wasn't an ordinary dame. The Venetian blinds cast a shadowed band across her sultry, Walmart-glossed lips. I asked if it was business or pleasure. She didn't answer, but revealed a six-pack of Natty Ice from her purse and aimed it right at me. If she'd opened fire right then, foam would have knocked me over and sprayed my talking Billy Bass wall ornament. Then she said, "Are you Nick Dumpwater? How is a Joe like me supposed to answer?" They're coming at us right there.
Inspiring parody and pastiche, just a conversation.
Yeah, right.
You know, I think Eileen put her finger on something that I think is important in talking about this stuff. That is, on the one hand, writers like Hyas and Barry and so on are over the top, and they're a lot more, as she said quite rightly, more naturalistic writers. And yet, as she said, Hyacin's over the top corresponds quite closely to the police blotter, to the things that are actually so. And I think one of the things that's always true whenever you're writing about a region or a city is, on the one hand, this question of credibility. Is it like that? But there's also the question of, what should we call it, of indelibility. Is it unforgettable? Is that aspect of it unforgettable? Mm-hmm. You know, very few people in New York talk like Damon Runyon characters out of Guys and Dolls.
Right.
But there's something indelible about Damon Runyon because it caught that central New York frenetic, over-talking, too fancy diction for sordid circumstances. And I think we respond to a wonderful writer like Hyacin, not just as a witness, as a kind of journalist, but also as an imaginative writer, exactly because we see in his over-the-topness, the over-the-topness of American life.
Let's go to Andrew in Bowling Green, Kentucky. Andrew, you're on with Adam and Aileen.
Hi, Tom. The great thing about Florida is this, that reflects the rest of America, is the sort of granular nature of the culture. It's not quite the melting pot. I mean, this is a place where Appalachia meets Rio de Janeiro, and there are really wonderful, unexpected things to be found, and it's sort of void spaces that we're just now filling in. It's the unexpected that's possible there, in a way that, whereas L.A. was the far side of Westing, of the far side of the settling of America, of Horatio Alger, setting yourself up good. Florida is, I guess, the far side of a mix of retirement and, moving closer to the Daytona 500. I don't know. It's just...
Is it the melting pot, Andrew, or not?
Sort of. I told him earlier it was a spoiled melting pot, maybe, but it maintains a certain level of distance, one particle to another. It is, there's a granularity there, but it doesn't quite melt. But at the same time, it puts everything in closer contact than it would be otherwise. And I think it's in that tension between those somewhat maintained cultures that we get the potential for such great fiction and stories.
Oh, Andrew, I love your call so much. Adam Gopnicki's right on your theme there, that
absolutely.
Particularity.
That's a wonderful term of phrase, you know, part Appalachia, part Rio de Janeiro.
Yeah.
And, of course, in Carl Hyacin's writing, that's always happening. You have kind of, Appalachian types who are suddenly emerging into a Latin world. Maybe you could say it's not the melting pot, it's the molting pot. That is, it's people are continually shedding their skins and finding some other. And I think it's quite true that California still represents in our minds the outer limit of the dream of the frontier. Florida represents something very different. It represents the new face of emigration for good and ill. Also, I think something about the way that we live in little subcultures very much now. One of the things that I love in Carl Hyacin's fiction is the way he gets small places right, like a striptease club. And instead of representing it as a place of temptation and transgression, he represents it in that fine novel Striptease, made into a less good movie, as a business. Here's how it works. Here's how it goes on. And here's how a woman, a good woman, a virtuous woman, an admirable woman, makes a living by taking her clothes off.
She says better than working at Burger King.
Yeah, exactly. And that kind of sense of the hidden subcultures of American life, the things that we don't talk about, exactly as your caller was saying, in granular detail. Boy, that's one of the great things that literature does for us. It tells us, you see the outside of the strip club, here's how it happens, and here's what goes on inside the mind of the women we watch
at the pole.
As they undress.
Aileen Cogdill, do Floridians take this Florida crime fiction to the beach or I don't know where, the spa? Do they revel in it, or are they repulsed by the depiction?
Oh, no, no. I think Florida crime fiction readers are very much live in Florida because they know how bizarre the crimes are.
And they also know that no matter how over the top Hyacin or Tim Dorsey or Dave Barry go, that the reality is much more worse, actually. I mean, there was a few years ago, a sheriff's deputy was talking about the evils of marijuana, and a few feet away from him plummeted from the sky a 75 bale of cocaine. I mean, you can't make that stuff up.
Oh, my gosh.
As Dave Barry loves to say, right?
It's raining cocaine.
And as over the top as high as it is, he grounds each of those novels in reality. For example, Striptease was very much about a politician, I think in the 80s, who became infatuated with this stripper and who just, imploded, basically. And Hyacin also shows Key West, which is very much even more of a last frontier for Floridians. Mm. I think in Bad Monkey, he really shows how bizarre that is. A few years ago, my husband and I were down in Key West, and an hour before we were there, several Cuban National Guard soldiers landed their boat near the dock where the cruise liners come. They walked down the street with machine guns held over their head, trying to surrender and requesting amnesty.
Oh, jeez.
Nobody paid attention to them for like an hour.
Oh, you cannot make it up.
You cannot make that up, and that is reality. We get down there, and we see the newspaper, go, oh, my God.
let me get Pat on here from Boston. Pat, thanks for calling in. You're on the air.
Okay. I grew up in the Northeast, but spent a little time working in the cruise ship industry, mostly in southern Florida.
Oh, boy.
And what was so striking to me was the level, at least in southern Florida, in Miami and in the Keys, that the money, the smuggling culture, the fact that so much of the wealth came from smuggling just kind of bubbled to the surface. I mean, on the ships, and it very much leads to what your guest was saying, I would hear these stories about cocaine being run in the hulls or about officers disappearing through the pipes. And I never got them confirmed, but I certainly could believe them. I think it's part of that. So much of it is, it's happened in Boston, certainly. We've had plenty of smugglers, but we always hit it. And as your guest has said, the smuggling culture always felt on the surface to me.
Yeah, right out there. Pat, I appreciate your call right off the cruise ship. Let me get one more here from Taos, New Mexico. Kalev is calling. Kalev, you're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Hello.
Hi.
Hello, Tom.
Hi.
I grew up in Miami in the 40s and moved out west finally in the 80s. But before moving out, I hung out on the southwest coast of Florida, Sanibel Island. And I'm partial to Randy Wainwright.
That's his terrain, Sanibel Island.
Yes.
Right. And because his geography and his references are 100% accurate, he talks about going up to Yosepa Island to do a fish count. Well, heck, I've been on Yosepa, hung out there for a long time. He talks about running up the Cabbage Key to have dinner with Rob Wells. Well, Rob Wells is an actual human being. He owns the island. And I've known him for a heck of a long time, although I haven't seen him in a while. So, I'm out here, and then I can get a bit of that southwest coast of Florida because I was sailing and boating down there in the 60s when there weren't quite as many people.
And it takes you right back there from New Mexico to jump into these books, you and a lot of others who take a trip when they read them. Let me get Judy calling in from Florida, Fort Peters, Florida. Judy, thanks. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Hi. My comment is, I think one factor that Florida has is the influx of New Yorkers and people from New Jersey just jumping on 95 and heading down here. We add them into the mix, and it makes for an interesting time.
Yeah, Hyacin calls it Newark with palm trees.
That's the mix,
exactly.
I think, is the key thing. The only thing I'd add, Tom, if you'd forgive little pedantic note, is that we read regional fiction because it speaks to national concerns, so that it's true that we can talk about the way that Florida crime fiction relates to the reality of Florida, and it's endlessly entertaining. But I do think that we're drawn to it, those of us who only are occasional visitors to Florida, we're frequent visitors to the Florida writing, because that imagery of this carnival of grotesques passing before our eyes in broad daylight, that says something about the way we imagine our country, even in places where it rains all the time, as here in New York.
Just right across the country, exactly. I mean, it's the thing that drew us to want to talk with you, Adam, because it's not just there. The popularity comes from the fact that something's being painted before our eyes here that we all recognize and feel a little piece of nationally.
Right. It comes in its most maybe lurid and its most wonderfully cartoon-like colors and its most caricatural-like intensity in Florida crime fiction. But just as we recognized in that old California crime fiction, something about American disillusionment that transcended Los Angeles, I think we recognize in this kind of writing, in Florida crime writing, we recognize something about American shamelessness that transcends the peninsula that it takes place on.
Let's get a call from New Orleans, city of character and color. Cynthia's calling. Hi, Cynthia, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I wanted to touch on something that Aline mentioned. I was given a book by Carl Hiaasen by English friends who said it was hilarious, and I can't remember the title because I was so horrified by the book I had to toss it across the room. And it deals with a private club where wealthy men can go shoot all of the collected remaining endangered species of the planet. Mm-hmm. And as I was reading it, I just had this horrible feeling that such a place actually exists. And when Aline says that she reads Carl Hiaasen as a documentarist, that just corroborated my feeling from that book. And I feel that if these people that he's writing about are thinly veiled descriptions of people who exist, I think we're in terrible trouble.
Aline, you're confirming Cynthia's worst fears. How about it here?
I am. And actually, that endangered animal preserve where you could go shoot did exist. I think there's been such an outcry about it that it no longer exists in Florida. But there are places like that in Arizona and California and I think even Nevada. And it appalls me, too. It is true.
And I think if you say, what's the larger lesson of that? What's the thing that binds together? It's the idea that the pursuit of pleasure, of your own narrow, selfish idea of pleasure, ends up implicating you in really horrific things. And that's something that all of the good Florida satirists underline, I think.
Something for all of us to keep our eye on here. Let me get one more, if I may. Philip in Winston-Salem, North Carolina. Hi, Philip, you're on.
Hi, Tom. Love the show.
Thank you.
I was just calling a 30-year airline employee trapped in Florida hotels and remember fondly the two Lebanese or Syrian guys who were selling gyros in the parking lot of the strip club. and that was the only food available at midnight for tired airline crews. Never actually made it into Baby Dolls or whatever the name of the strip club was. But Florida is, it's the good and the bad of American society, you know?
Mm-hmm. There you are, trapped in the Tampa Hotel with the Lebanese guys and the Baby Doll Strip Club. And maybe you don't need the Florida crime fiction just at that moment. I don't know, Aline, what do you see? If Florida is the new frontier of our imagination or fears or hopes, does it work?
Well, it does. I mean, Florida is also a place where you can re-identify yourself, come up with a new identity, a new life, and start fresh. And I think there's a lot of hope down here, and I think it's also kind of reflected in some of the mysteries like by James W. Hall, the funny ones by Elaine Dietz, Tim Dorsey, even with his over-the-top serial killer. There's a lot there, and I think there certainly is a lot of hope for those of us who live in Florida. And it's a lot of fun. I mean, actually, I'm delighted when something weird happens in California. It's like...
takes the pressure off.
It's certainly brimming with life, and there's fun all through it.
Yeah, in the paper today, there was some bozo in the middle of Florida was picking wild mushrooms, the funny kind, and in his backpack, he had a 2-foot alligator stuff that he was just going to, take pictures of. The thing was alive.
Okay.
Kind of
little backpack plus some funny mushrooms, and we're off. Adam Gopnik, if it's a totem, a harbinger of what?
Well, I should say I love my trips to Florida. Miami Book Festival is one of my favorites. Key West Literary Seminar. These are the great trips in an itinerant writer's life. The ones marked Miami or Key West are the wonderful ones. I think that it is, we live in a country where this carnival of grotesques is something that we're accustomed to. It's all a part of our way of looking at television, and any literature that reflects it has power on us.
Adam Gopnik, when you pick up a subject and write about it, we love to read that. This was a wonderful essay in the current issue of The New Yorker. We're so happy for the chance to talk with you about it this hour. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Tom.
Adam Gopnik of The New Yorker and Aline Cogdill. You are the best. I hope you keep writing about mystery, Florida mystery, and all others for a long, long time. Thanks for being with us from Fort Lauderdale today, Aline.
Thank you. I enjoyed it very much.
Aline Cogdill. Thanks to all those Florida writers. We'll go out with a little bit of course, Miami Vice. Tomorrow in this hour, Kevin Kwan's new novel, Crazy Rich Asians. Don't miss it. Thanks for being with us today. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.